Today, I'm going to focus on the poetry of Rumi. I invite you to listen with me as he talks with his God, Allah. We'll learn a bit about him, but his message will come mostly through Rumi's poetry, his words. He speaks so directly to and of his God. Jalaluddin Balkhi, known today as Rumi, was born in 1207 in what is now Afghanistan, but then was part of the Persian Empire. Because of the threat posed by the invading Mongol armies of Genghis Khan, his family moved west, eventually to Konya in modern-day Turkey. With his father, he was part of a dervish learning community. But when his father died, the then 25-year-old Jalaluddin assumed the leadership role of this Sufi community. Rumi was a contemporary of St. Francis of Assisi, and he did visit Christians. Sufism is a mystical branch of Islam, distinct from either the Sunnis or the Shiites. The Sufis started as a group of purists protesting the worldliness they saw overtaking Islam. So they wore wool instead of the silk and satin of the sultans and the caliphs. Thus comes the word Suf for wool. The Sufis wanted to purify and spiritualize Islam from within, seeking an inner mystical core. Like Christian mystics, they had their particular methods of approaching this knowledge. They gathered around spiritual masters and formed, after the 12th century, orders. While they called themselves fakir, those poor in spirit, they were really a spiritual elite. These folks generally married and were not cloistered. They engaged in the usual occupations, but gathered to sing, dance, pray, recite their rosaries in concert, and listen to their master's discourses. They sought direct experience with God. An analogy was used to explain their ways. If someone wants to know about fire, they can learn it by degrees. First, by hearing about it, then by seeing it, and finally, by being burned by its heat. Sufis wanted to be burned by God, to be intimate with the ultimate. They had three routes to God: the mysticism of love, that of ecstasy, and that of intuition. Intuitive discernment is a mental knowledge, discernment through an organ they called the eye of the heart. It is a different sort of knowledge. Objects are clothed in a celestial light. The words ornaments are garments that God dons to create a world. To the eye of the heart, the world is God in disguise or God veiled. Ecstatic mysticism depends on an altered state of consciousness, something like a trance. They lose attention for who they are and where they are in the real world. The mysticism of love began with an 8th century woman saint who discovered in her all-night vigils that God's love was at the core of the universe. They believed that steeping oneself in that love and reflecting it to others is living life's supreme beatitude. Persian poets often dwell on the pangs of separation to deepen their love of God, and in doing so, draw close to God. Rumi's poetry falls in this category. Here is an example. It is called Love Dogs. One night a man was crying, "Allah, Allah!" His lips grew sweet with the praising until a cynic said, "So, have you ever heard? I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response?" The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep. He dreamed he saw Qadir, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. "Why did you stop praising?" "Because I've never heard anything back." "This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. And here is another one about the reed found in a wetland pond, a reed cut to make a reed flute, perhaps. Listen to the story told by the reed of being separated. Since I was cut from the reed bed, I have made this crying sound. Anyone apart from someone they love understands what I say. Anyone pulled from a source longs to go back. At any gathering, I am there, mingling in the laughing and the grieving, a friend to each, but few will hear the secrets hidden within the notes, no ears for that. Body flowing out of spirit, spirit up from body, no concealing that mixing. But it's not given us to see the soul. The reed flute is fire, not wind. Be that empty. Hear the love fire tangled in the reed notes as bewilderment melts into wine. The reed is a friend to all who want the fabric torn and drawn away. The reed is hurt and salve combining. Intimacy and longing for intimacy, one song. A disastrous surrender and a fine love together. The one who secretly hears this is senseless. A tongue has one customer, the ear. A sugarcane flute has such effect because it was able to make sugar in the reed bed. The sound it makes is for everyone. Days full of wanting, let them go by without worrying. Stay where you are inside such a pure, hollow note. Every thirst gets satisfied except that of these fish, the mystics, who swim a vast ocean of grace, still somehow longing for it. No one lives in that without being nourished every day. But if someone doesn't want to hear the song of the reed flute, it's best to cut conversation short, say goodbye, and leave. The reed is nostalgic for union with its source, its God. Unfortunately, the reed cannot make its music until it is cut from its source, the reed bed. Rumi's father was a jurist, theologian, and mystic. Rumi studied not with his father, who died when Rumi was in his 20s, but with a student of his father's. His life was apparently a normal one for a religious scholar until he met a stranger with a question. Shams of Tabriz was a wanderer searching for someone who would tolerate his company. Shams and Rumi were infatuated with each other, not in sexual terms, but as spiritual friends. They went off to a retreat place for months, an endless conversation. This caused jealousy among Rumi's students, so Shams went to Damascus for a while. And then Rumi sent his son to Syria to persuade him to return. Again, the intense conversations shut out Rumi's students, and again, they were jealous. It appears they colluded with Rumi's son to have him killed. In his grief, Rumi circled a pole in his garden, all the while speaking poetry, which has come to be known as the most intimate record we have of the search for divine companionship. His turning around that pole is the start of the moving meditations of the dervishes. The movement, begun in grief, has turned into a dance in celebration of life. Coleman Barks, a popular translator of Rumi, says that Rumi is trying to get us to feel the vastness of our true identity, like the sense you might get walking into a cathedral, what Jesus referred to when he said, the kingdom of God is within you. And another poem called The Freshness. When it's cold and raining, you are more beautiful, and the snow brings me even closer to your lips. The inner secret, that which was never born, you are that freshness, and I am with you now. I can't explain the goings or the comings. You enter suddenly, and I am nowhere again, inside the majesty. Hi! Oh! Such life, such life. After Sham's death, Rumi did find two successive companions to whom he addressed his poems and with whom he continued his conversations. Contrary to much of Islam, which eschews music, the Sufis delight in it, and Rumi wrote poetry about music too. In the Sufi way, song is story, is poetry, is prayer. This poem is called Where Everything is Music. Don't worry about saving these songs. If one of our instruments breaks, it doesn't matter. We have fallen into the place where everything is music. The strumming and the flute notes rise into the atmosphere, and even if the whole world's harp should burn up, there will still be hidden instruments playing. So the candle flickers and goes out. We have a piece of flint and a spark. This singing art is sea foam. The graceful movements come from a pearl somewhere on the ocean floor. Poems reach up like spindrift and the edge of driftwood along the beach, wanting. They derive from a slow and powerful root that we can't see. Stop the words now. Open the window in the center of your chest and let the spirits fly in and out. In some poems, it's hard to tell whether he is referring to human love or love of the divine. For this one, with the beloved's water of life, no illness remains. In the beloved's rose garden of union, no thorn remains. They say there is a window from one heart to another. How can there be a window where no wall remains? Other times, it is easier to see that Rumi refers to God. In this poem called Story Water, it seems a bit easier. A story is like water that you heat for your bath. It takes messages between the fire and your skin. It lets them meet, and it cleans you. Very few can sit down in the middle of the fire itself. Like a salamander or Abraham, we need intermediaries. A feeling of fullness comes, but it usually takes some bread to bring it. Beauty surrounds us, but usually we need to be walking in a garden to know it. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. Water, stories, the body, all the things that we do are mediums that hide and show what's hidden. Study them and enjoy this being washed with a secret we sometimes know and then not. Rumi was without boundaries, according to Coleman Barks, his translator. He would say that love is the religion and the universe is the book. That experience, as we're living it, is the sacred text that we study. So that puts us all in the same God club. Rumi's poetry is a constant conversation, a constant adulation of his God. He had no trouble finding words for this very concrete personage in his life. Another person who apparently had no problem speaking to God is Rita Kretchen. Perhaps you too have been as fascinated as I have by this middle-aged, ordinary woman who survived 49 days in the wilderness on almost no food. Water, yes, but very little food. The key to survival in these kinds of situations is the mental battle, people say, experts say. Do you have sufficient will to survive despite your circumstances? Can you maintain a positive outlook? How do you not get discouraged? One of the things that Kretchen did was to rely on her Christian faith. She read her Bible that she had with her. She prayed. One of her favorite passages is Psalm 86, a prayer of David. It reads, "Hear me, Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Guard my life, for I am faithful to you. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Have mercy on me, Lord, for I call to you all day long. Bring joy to your servant, Lord, for I put my trust in you. You, Lord, are forgiving and good, abounding in love to all who call to you. Hear my prayer, Lord. Listen to my cry for mercy. When I am in distress, I call to you, because you answer me." Now, Mrs. Kretchen wanted more than a mystical connection to God. She needed more than a yearning. She needed physical rescue, a physical manifestation from God. Each of these people had a direct line to support during distress. Because they were accustomed to looking for emotional sustenance through God, doing so during a difficult time was a natural response. I have been wondering all this week, perhaps you have too, how would I have responded to being lost in the wilderness? Now, it's not like I never find myself in the wilderness. And no one knows when the wilderness will be a metaphorical place in which we get lost. I ask myself, what would sustain me in such a time of dire need? Many of us, including me, do not include prayer in our spiritual lives. I don't find the Bible nurturing like Rita did. So what might I have with me that I would find sustaining? I often notice the beauty in the wilderness around me. But would that beauty, whatever there was, happen to be there, would it be enough to sustain me? Would recalling my family, my father who survived the horrors of World War II, my mother who succumbed so early in life to cancer, my siblings, my dear husband, would those felt connections keep me going? Perhaps knowing that they care about me in my distress would give me the will to survive. I confess, I'm not willing to die to find out. I only hope that should I find myself in dire straits somewhere, I will not worry about finding the right word for God or figuring out what my belief about God is at the most that moment. I do hope that I would be able to use my connection to the world to keep myself going. May you fare as well. Rumi's poetry reflects the yearning we all have for connection with something beyond ourselves, whether divine or human. We all yearn for his message of love and connection. Rumi's words offer an all-encompassing spirituality relevant to our times, being present in the moment, finding the holiness in laughter. Amen.